I think a lot of women don't want to be the token woman on a panel, and I think that's crazy. I think I would happily make the choice to be the token woman on a panel, because if you get out there and show people that you are worth listening to, they will ask you back. Mm-hmm. And they will ask people like you back. And it's a start, you know, it's a start to get people listening. And I think it's important for women to say yes to these opportunities, no matter what.
Hello, everyone. My name is Christine Minotto. I'm the director of the UCSF Rosamond Institute at the University of California, San Francisco. And welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. It's hard to know where to start when introducing today's guest, Lisa Sinan. She's leader of Manet Phelps and Phillips digital and technology businesses, as well as the firm's venture capital fund. She's also co-founder of C-Sweetener, a nonprofit organization that connects women in leadership with mentors. She operates Venture Valkyrie LLC, a media firm that houses the Venture Valkyrie blog and the Tectonic podcast. That's right, Lisa is a podcast host, so I'm even more thrilled to learn from her. Listen on to hear about her amazing achievement and career path. Enjoy our conversation, and if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Well, thanks for joining me, Lisa, today.
Delighted to be here.
It's on a sunny spring day. Finally, the rain is over.
I know.
And so I listened to your podcast, and it's been great. And I was like, it's time for somebody to ask about Lisa. So I said, like, let's invite Lisa to our podcast.
Thank you.
And so you have quite an experience. You've done a lot of things, you know, in your work and also outside work.
Yeah.
And so tell us about your new role you just took on.
My new role is I am the group leader of digital technology practice at Manet Phelps, and I'm also running their venture fund. So I'm doing both consulting and venture work, and venture work and consulting.
Okay.
But working across all healthcare and also other industries in tech.
So the consulting firm has a venture arm.
Yeah. So Manet Phelps is a large professional services firm. It's got a full service strategy consulting firm, full service law firm, and a venture fund.
Okay.
So my practice runs across all of those. So I've got a team of people working as consultants, working on digital transformation, technology, venture, innovation, digital health, all of that, and also digital outside of health. And then I've got a team of people who are lawyers, who are in IP, transactions, venture, all sorts of things. And then I've got a small venture fund that I manage for the firm.
It's almost like you get a great full service for your venture.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, a lot of smart people to rely on for information, for sure.
How is that? Because you also work at GE Ventures before. How is that different in
Because
it's a corporate ventures versus more like a consulting services with ventures.
So GE Ventures, I was running the healthcare venture fund specifically and only that. Before I did that, I was a consultant for a while. Before I did that, I was in venture for a long time. So I've done both. You know, I've kind of gone back and forth. So I was really excited to find something where I could do both and simultaneously, and also not just healthcare, but bring some of the thinking about innovation to the tech side of the world as well.
So what do you think, what's going on with the GE healthcare these days?
I honestly don't know. I'm really disconnected from that, yeah.
I think their life sciences got acquired recently by Danaher.
Yeah, that's correct. On GE healthcare, which is different than GE Ventures. Yeah.
Right, yeah. So that's quite a surprise when I saw the announcement last year.
Yeah,
Lots going on over there. So what kind of things that you are investing in for this particular fund?
So for this fund, we invest really in anything that we believe is a good fit for, you know, creating a good financial return, has a financial or has a, you know, usually a technology focus or some combination of technology and services or, you know, technology and other capabilities. We've invested broadly in digital media and digital technologies generally. We've done a few digital health deals. The one we're just about to close is actually a fund, so we're also investing in some funds.
Okay.
So yeah, it's pretty eclectic. It's really focused on returns, not being a strategic fund per se, although sometimes we do also work with the investments as their consultant or as their law firm or whatever.
So you don't have to require the company to work with this consultant?
No. The fund is really the money comes from the firm and also the partners, but really it's the partner's money in the end.
Yeah.
And it's really primarily focused on returns.
Okay. And are you allowed to disclose the fund size?
We invest probably, you know, $1.5 million to $2 million a year. It's like an evergreen fund.
Okay.
And usually in smaller chunks. So it's not a fund that leads deals. It, you know, participates in syndicates with other venture funds and groups that, you know, like to work with us and that we like to work with. So,
it's
a bit of a different model than I've been in the past.
Yeah. So how do you end up doing ventures? Like, you know,
From the beginning, you mean?
From the beginning, yeah.
Well, I was earlier in my career in the 1990s on the operating side in healthcare.
And what kind of healthcare?
I was on the executive team of a managed behavioral healthcare company that was originally called American Biodyne and later called Merit Behavioral Care. We started there when it was very small, and I
think become United Healthcare person.
No, I became Agilent.
Agilent, okay.
So when I joined, it was, you know, just had one or two clients. And when I, we grew it from there to about $800 million in revenue over the 9 years I was there. It went public, did really well. And then later we got acquired by Magellan.
Okay. So what is like, I mean, I've never worked, what does that mean, behavioral care?
Mental health and substance abuse.
Okay.
And so the guys that I was working with there running that company, when we sold the company the final time, we decided to work on starting a venture fund that was focused on the same kind of conceptual orientation that we had at the company, which was around finding ways of improving quality and reducing cost at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, back in the 90s, that was considered a crazy idea, that you could actually do things cheaper in healthcare if they were good. And but we felt strongly that it was not only possible, but it was necessary for the healthcare system. So we started a fund to do that, called Silos Group back then at the time. And then I spent 15 years there. So really, I got into it much by accident. It really wasn't by design.
Yeah. That's a large fund. Is it they're still investing?
No, it's no longer investing. Yeah.
It's hundreds of million dollars size fund.
Yeah. It had $600 million under management when it sort of, you know, decided to stop raising another fund.
Yeah.
And so I went from there to working in on my own as a consultant, but I was still working heavily in venture, working with venture funds and innovation groups on how to optimize what they were doing, do it better, or to start something. So I helped start the American Heart Association's venture fund called Cardiation Capital.
Okay.
How
does that work? Because they're not for profit.
Yeah.
And
so is UCSF, but it does venture investing, right?
Well, I think we do it slightly, but we're doing it outside university.
Uh-huh.
Right. How do you guys do?
Yeah, well, the venture fund was also structured as a for-profit, and managed by a fund called Aphelion. So in a joint sort of investment committee model. So
Aphelion with Ned Sheets?
Ned Sheets, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So Ned's managing that. The focus of that fund is companies that are aligned with the mission of the Heart Association. Philips and UPMC are also investors in that fund. So it's a very sophisticated thinking that goes on there about, you know, cardiovascular and stroke.
So when you help them to structure the fund, are you part of the team who raised the money to, or you just help them with?
I was. I was there to conceptualize it, to get it approved by the board, to get it going, to ultimately put them together with Ned and
how hard is it to convince a company like that size to do?
They're a massive organization. I mean, they raise hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars a year, but in a very different model, right? They're looking mostly to do research grants and the like, although they're very sophisticated, and they've created a number of businesses actually that, you know, bring in a fair amount of revenue. So I think they're very entrepreneurial, and they were very open to the idea and interested in the idea of using money, you know, that they could access and leveraging it with other people's money to advance things into practice. Mm-hmm. Because they do, you know, fund research, massive amounts of it, right? Hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And they, I guess the thing that they felt they didn't get to do is to, you know, invest or, you know, put money behind getting things actually out into the market, commercialization right. phase. So that's what Cardiation is doing.
Okay. More practical.
Yeah.
To get things to the patient.
Right.
And yeah, I think I start seeing more company like CHCF. Mm-hmm. They're doing more investing as well.
Well, they've been investing probably 10 years right. now, actually. I've been on the board for that. Maybe it's 8 years. I don't know.
Okay.
I was on the board of that fund for many years, actually just came off it. It's really a social venture fund focused right. on investing in for-profit companies that mm-hmm. do work for underserved populations,
right.
Medicaid in California primarily. But they've made some great investments, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting sometimes being, you know, meeting a lot of the entrepreneurs, the Medicaid population is oftentimes a second thought.
Yeah.
And because I think everybody feel like there's no money to be made. How, you know, the kind of company that CHCF investing, I'm sure there's, you know, there's social impact,
mm-hmm.
but like at the end of the day, they want to see their money return as well. So how?
Yeah, well, they've invested in companies that have made them some money.
Right.
I mean, for sure.
Right. So it's not true that if you're in a Medicaid, you can't.
Yeah, I think, you know, now granted, a lot of those companies are both Medicaid and commercial or Medicaid and Medicare or whatever. But I used to, in my old behavioral health business, we did a lot of Medicaid work. And I don't agree that money can't be made there and made fairly. I think mm-hmm. that, you know, it's regulated. There's low reimbursement. Right. That's all true. But there's an awful lot of people
right.
in Medicaid, right? It's a very, very large market. And there's egregious inefficiencies. And I think there are many ways to bring new technologies and services to bear to improve what goes on there. I mean, we've seen a couple new venture funds formed around that idea. Town mm-hmm. Hall is one, mm-hmm. You know, that is investing purely down this power alley. So yeah. I think we'll see. You know, I think it'll be interesting to see how these things play out over time.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's hard to argue that such a big market can't produce
right.
good businesses.
Yeah. And so it's how do you, I mean, I think with that population is addressed, then it can solve a lot of the other healthcare issues that we have because it's such a huge population, like you said.
Yeah, it's complicated, right? Because I think the populations that are served by Medicaid often need things that are not usually considered healthcare things
mm-hmm.
to address their healthcare needs.
Like, for example?
Housing, transportation, social support services, you know, mm-hmm. access to healthy foods, childcare.
Right.
You know. You can't take care of your diabetes effectively if you can't refrigerate your insulin, right? So I think these organizations need to be extra creative about how to serve their populations.
Mm-hmm.
And especially since many of these things aren't normally covered by Medicaid's payment structures, they can be under Medicaid, you know, managed care plans. But it's just complicated and interesting. But I think, you know, they're very far ahead in many ways about thinking about the whole person
mm-hmm.
more than we do in the commercial side of medicine.
Right. Yeah, because I think there's a lot of other challenges in their personal life that impacting their healthcare.
Right.
So people in this Medicaid space, they talk a lot about access to care.
Mm-hmm.
And what does it really mean? Because we always assume, like, why can't they have access to care?
Because doctors don't take Medicaid patients a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I think the numbers are something like, on average in California, I don't remember the exact numbers, it's going to be wrong, but something like 30-40% of doctors will accept Medicaid patients.
Mm-hmm.
That means mostly they don't.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in a rural community, there's hardly any specialists out there. You know, it's a really difficult challenge. I think telemedicine is one of the great, you know, opportunities in Medicaid. You know, I think serving remote populations, underserved populations, if you can get to them with the right people at the right time,
yeah,
you can really make a difference.
I think sometimes if you're not exposed in that kind of that population, you don't really understand the challenge. So as a result of that, probably
mm-hmm.
people don't come up with
yeah.
an innovation in that space.
I had somebody ask me today, you know, and her question was well-intentioned, but she said, why can't we just solve this with these concierge medicine programs where you can call and go pay $300 to see a specialist without having to go through your health plan? And I said, well, because $300 is a lot of money to a lot of people, and they don't have that to spare to self-refer to a cardiologist.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And I think those of us who live in different circumstances have to remember that.
Yeah, I think that, and sometimes it's hard because sometimes you don't realize that we're in everybody's in their own bubble too.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, our bubble is pretty big here.
Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based med tech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into a unique healthcare solution. For more information, visit their website at iolifescience.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Brown Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com.
But I'm curious about your work on the behavioral care area, because that's mental illness, which is a huge problem. And how do you, you know, how is that company addressing that? And how do you think that, you know, this challenge need to be addressed?
Oh, God, it's such a big question. I mean, and it breaks down into lots of different categories. I mean, there's people with sort of, you know, everyday mental, you know, mental health challenges like anxiety and depression, which are moderate or mild. And, you know, that affects their health. So people with mental health diagnoses and conditions undiagnosed have higher medical costs, you know. There's people with severe medical or mental health conditions, you know, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, very severe, you know, problems who have, oh my goodness, you know, so many challenges just getting through their lives day to day and, to, you know, getting on the right medication and getting proper services and the like. It's very challenging. In substance abuse, there's sort of the, you know, the what doesn't look so bad by comparison now to opioid stuff. You know, there's all the, you know, the drinking problems, which are actually really far more serious than most drug problems.
And they don't get covered and don't
talk about them
so much,
the same way. And then, of course, there's everything like you know, the opioid addiction problem now. So there's just a lot of different challenges. And treatments, I think, are by and large a patchwork of guessing.
Yeah.
For a lot of these things, right? And even just for basic, mild, moderate depression or anxiety, you might try 3 or 4 different drugs before one ever works for you, if one ever works for you.
Right.
Counseling, finding a counselor is very difficult. If you find that matches and fits you well, is even more difficult. It's a really big problem. And I think we, as a society, finally seem to be paying attention to it. It finally seems to be allowed to talk about.
Yeah.
You see, we're seeing, you know, company CEOs and famous people and, you know, begin to speak of these things out loud and get overcome the stigma. Mm-hmm. Because for so long, people just suffered because they were too embarrassed to talk about it. And it's just, it's such a sad state because all it is just a different part of your body being a little out of tune and needing help or being very out of tune and needing help. You know, nobody would make fun of you for your, you know, for having a broken knee, right? So I think, we really have to stop putting this in its own box because it drives so much of the cost and the challenge in medicine overall. And I'm hopeful because I'm seeing a lot of new companies emerge. You know, it's funny, when I left behavioral health and went into venture, which was in 1998, so a pretty long time ago, I didn't see any behavioral health innovation for 10 or 12 years. Nothing. Not a single thing, you know?
Yeah.
And now in the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a ton of stuff coming together. Now, will any of it be effective? And, you know, we'll see.
Yeah.
Still early for most, but I there's a lot more interest in it.
I was looking into the company called Wobot.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Wobot, right.
Because at that time I was looking for, interested in bringing her, the founder, to speak. And I was like, so it's pretty interesting. And I thought that kind of, if it works, it's kind of nice. It lowered the cost. People seeking help.
I know. I was at the South by Southwest conference last weekend, and it was fun. It's always fun. But I was emceeing the pediatric innovation part of it, and one of the companies there has a treatment for babies born to opioid-addicted mothers, so babies born with opioid addiction, basically, who struggle, right? They can't sleep, they can't relax, they don't eat well. But it was really cool because it was like a vibrational thing mm-hmm. that goes in their bed, and it's the company's called...
it's not Lully, is it?
Propella. And it uses this stochastic vibration, so it's non-rhythmic, so the baby doesn't get addicted to the vibration.
Okay.
And seems to make a huge difference according to the work they've done. So hopefully that's the kind of thing. Yeah. You know, we can see more of these non-drug interventions that are effective. It's great.
That's kind of crazy that, you know, the impact is just the adult, but then the baby and...
Yeah, it's just sad.
It's great for the companies to do something like this because mm-hmm. I think pediatrics is another market that it's so hard to
get. There's not a lot of venture that goes into pediatrics.
Right. It's although I think somebody was telling me one time there's an orphan drugs, but then when it comes to devices, it's a forgotten child.
Yeah. I mean, the pediatric hospitals in America have banded together to do a lot of work collaboratively to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, collaboratives that focus on medical devices for babies and children, but they're, you know, still not funded to the extent that, you know, yet another balloon catheter is or whatever, right?
Yeah. So, no, but that's cool that you're in that conference.
Yeah, it was fun.
It's fun. I mean, I've never been, but...
I go to healthcare by day and movies by night.
Oh, she likes celebrity. So the other things, like, you know, as I mentioned earlier, that you've done a lot of the work and then you do something outside work, you do the sea sweetener.
Yeah.
And what's behind that and why you start that?
Sea sweetener is a company. It's like a match.com for matching women leaders in healthcare with mentors, male and female mentors. And I started because I was getting, and I still get, so many requests for mentorship or guidance or input or advice or call it what you want. Every week, so many that I can't possibly even respond to the emails, much less actually do it. And I was in the Aspen Institute Health Innovation Fellowship, and I had to do a project related to healthcare, and I was trying to think of something. And as I was sitting there on the last day that it was due, the proposal, I was looking through my email at the dozens of these emails I had from women, mm-hmm. and some men, but a lot of women, asking for advice and mentorship. And it struck me that not only was I not capable of servicing all of that, but I wasn't even the right person a lot of the time to talk to these people about what they were doing. And I had this, you know, I was thought, well, if only there was like a match.com to match. Oh, wait a minute. You know, and it was like, so that became my project for the Aspen Institute. And we've launched now 2 years ago. We have hundreds of people participating. We're trying to grow it. Uh-huh. But it's online at csweetener.org, and we've just launched a speakers bureau for women because I also get calls from so many conferences saying, we'd like to diversify and not have just mannels, but we don't know any women.
Right.
So, yeah. So we've put together a speakers bureau filled with great women speakers that they can come and access.
And do you give them the criteria that when somebody asks you, then you need to say yes?
Oh, to the women?
Yeah.
You certainly encourage it. I mean, the women who signed up Speaks Brew obviously want to say yes because they volunteered to be in it. But yeah, you know, I think a lot of women do turn these opportunities down. And sometimes they turn them down because they say, I don't want to be the token woman on mm-hmm. a panel. And I think that's crazy. I think I would happily make the choice to be the token woman on a panel because if you get out there and show people that you are worth listening to, they will ask you back. Mm-hmm. And they will ask people like you back. And it's a start, you know, it's a start to get people listening. And I think it's important for women to say yes to these opportunities, no matter what, you know, and to encourage their colleagues. And when they get asked to recommend somebody, recommend women, not just, you know, the guy that they may know.
Yeah.
To really think about it. I think women are, you know, part of fixing the problem. Women need to also step up and do what they need to do.
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes we sometimes understand that women who speak who are really, you know, the leaders, they got asked a lot too. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, we understand sometimes they have to decline.
Right. So, you know, how do you set that priority?
But then they should offer you with somebody else.
Right.
I try to
That's
do that.
That's a good one.
I try to do that every time I say no, because I do get asked a lot, which is really nice, but I can't always do it. So then I try to recommend somebody else that I know.
Yeah. I think that's a good advice. Mm-hmm. I should ask that next time when somebody mm-hmm. turned me down. I
yeah.
try to bring more diversity
exactly.
in a symposium that we do every year.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be June 19 this year.
Nobody will ever beat the Game of Thrones panel that I did that a couple of years ago.
That was a good one. That was a fun one. Everybody's not studying. Wasn't that Game of Thrones? And I found the funniest, like, nobody read the Game of Thrones.
I know. The whole panel was full of people who didn't watch it. It was hilarious, but yeah. we had fun doing it.
But I love that. It's like, oh, I don't know what that means. So that was kind of fun. So you're doing the podcast.
Yeah. Tectonics,
so why do you do the tectonics? Why, you know, what got you started in that?
So for many years, I've written a blog called Venture Valkyrie. For, I don't know, probably 12 years now, I've been doing that. And I was starting to just put a lot of stuff on Twitter, and I met a guy through Twitter, which I guess is as good as, you know, using Match.com, and a guy named David Shaywitz, who we got to know each other, we got to be friendly, and he suggested we write a book together,
okay.
which we did, called Tectonics. And when that was done, he said, you know, podcasts are kind of the next thing. Why don't we try doing a podcast together? And I said, what the hell is a podcast? I mean, honestly, I really wasn't familiar with the medium. And but we really enjoy working together, and we really hit it off, and we decided, sure, why not? Let's give it a shot. We found a great producer from Connected Social Media and started inviting people, and lo and behold, they say yes, you know?
Yeah.
So now here we are, and it's almost 5 years later, I think. We've done 100 shows just about and featuring amazing people from healthcare of all different types. And we've had the best time talking to them because it's like this. You get to talk to people who you're fascinated by
right.
or enjoy talking to and hopefully impart some wisdom along the way. And it's I really enjoy doing it. So why do I do it? Well, at first I did it because David made me do it. And then later it became part of my focus on really getting my name out there and the name of my company, you know, and branding for myself and my firm. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's really effective, and especially again for women, personal branding is an important part of succeeding. And between the blog and the podcast and the other stuff I do on the speaking circuit, I think it's really helped raise my profile in a positive way to help me get business.
So that's great. Digress a little bit too. Like I was thinking about, you know, because you're half passionate in healthcare,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I sometimes, you know, when you're a doctor, it makes sense. Like, okay, you're passionate with healthcare, but you were not medical students or anything
no.
like that. You're political.
You have a master's in political science. Yeah.
Rather than become a politician or a lawyer, you know why?
How rude!
How do you?
You know, I originally wanted to be a political journalist.
Yeah.
I wanted to be like Woodward and Bernstein.
Okay.
That was my original plan. But journalism was already changing by the time I graduated from college and was heading to grad school and work. And I realized that wasn't going to be an optimal mm-hmm. place to go. So I was kind of casting around, and I had an opportunity and met through my dad to meet the CEO, the founder of this behavioral health company. And I tried, and I was like, sure, that sounds interesting. You know, it really wasn't about a passion. It was more about a desire to do something interesting and meaningful, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
But I really liked it. I mean, it really struck me how many interesting things there are when you get into healthcare, whether they're economic or clinical or business, you know, things, very diverse set of issues.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, ended up there.
So what was your first job at that company? What was your role?
At the healthcare startup?
That healthcare startup.
My first job was VP of marketing.
Okay. Well, that's a good job.
Yeah, it was a really little startup, and I got this great job. And, I'd worked in tech for a while, not that long, but in marketing. So I had some experience.
Yeah.
Lord knows, not enough to get, I mean, crazy. It's crazy how things go. And I eventually also took over most of sales and some of the operations of the company and built a government division as well. I did a lot of different things there.
That's kind of good because it allows you to grow.
Yeah, I mean,
on.
I When I got there, there were 50 people. When I left, there were thousands, you know?
Yeah.
So
it's, I mean, what made that company, looking back now, how it become so successful?
I think it had a really good model. Again, it really focused on putting patients in the right type of care, get the right amount of care, align the financial incentives of the payers and the providers and the patients, really think about personalizing the recommendations for care. So
that probably costs quite a bit of money to personalize.
No, it costs less money. If you put people in the right treatment at the right time and the right amount, it costs less money.
Okay.
You know, I think that was the big revelation of that. That if you use the continuum of care instead of just inpatient care, which was really all that people used at that time for mental health, you could really save a lot of money and give people better outcomes. So I think it was exciting to see that, you know, especially since when I started, the people who I asked for advice said, oh my God, that sounds like a terrible idea. And, you know, they were wrong. I mean, it was really a successful company. It had a really dynamic management team, great people, which is always part of success. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a wild ride.
Yeah, well, that's kind of fun. So I always like to ask people about what book they read because it's kind of more for my selfish reason. Then I don't have to browse through library to see like which book that I should read. So what book have you read recently? Or book that you remember?
Recently I read a book called Rocket Men, which is by an author I particularly like. He's written a lot of really good books that are nonfiction about interesting events. He wrote Shadow Divers, which was one of my favorite books. And Rocket Man's about the first trip to the orbit of the moon and how it was largely unplanned that particular set of astronauts and that particular rocket were going to go there. And it was about the space race with Russia. But it was also really about the families of the astronauts. It's a great book. It's like you hang on the edge of your seat. It's a wonderful book, but it's nonfiction. And that's my favorite kind of book.
Yeah.
It's true story, well told.
Yeah.
I'm on I'm the chairman of the advisory board for NASA and Baylor's Translational Medicine Research Institute for Space Medicine.
Okay.
They're planning the healthcare needs for the mission to Mars.
Okay.
The mission to deep space to Mars. And
for the astronauts?
Yeah.
Okay.
For the astronauts. And it's fascinating. I mean, it's unbelievably fascinating. So having this real life experience of engaging with astronauts and the people around NASA and on this group who are working on it and really dynamic folks led by Dorit Donneville, it's fun to read that book and think about what they were thinking about back then, you know, in the 60s, such a different time. So
what kind of thing that they would be thinking about?
Well, they certainly weren't focused on planning for the health issues the same way they are now.
Okay.
You know, and the health issues going to moon are a lot different than going to Mars. But, you know, it was much more about the mission, much more about the technology of the ship and not as much about the people, right? And it's not that they didn't care about the people. Of course they did. But
as long as you come back alive, then we're good.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, they weren't thinking about maybe as deeply the long-term radiation impact on people and things like that, bone impact on people of being out there. So it's quite fascinating. And the book's really a good read.
Yeah. So. Okay. Now I'm going to try to check it out. I've been reading Educated.
Oh, I heard that was good.
That was really good.
Yeah.
It's kind of like similar to this kind of thing. It's a nonfiction.
Yeah.
It's about a story. So, okay. Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's been fun.
Very fun.
Okay, cool.
Take care.